Our goddess wouldn't be here with us if what we are doing was displeasing to heaven. But Gorgias is dogged, plowing on. These stepsons tread where mortals don't belong, some of us think. They seek out battle high above their station. Who knows what power may yet take them and their mystic allies to task, bring them their comeuppance. And we'll bear the brunt of it, even if their commander is truly what he's rumored to be, a demigod, son of the storm god of the armies. That's no protection. Gods have been cast down for hubris before. They walk past a festival board loaded with shellfish and savouries, toward a fire pit where a lamb turns above hungry flames and fat spits and sizzles as it drips into the fire. Our patron goddess agreed that we should come here, Charon reminds Gorgias in a voice meant to carry to the two behind them. Not to safety, but to carry on. Blessed Harmony girt on her sword and donned her armor and came to sanctify our mission at the Mage Guild. She saved us all from the chilling mist that stepsons say can kill. Would you gainsay our own goddess? This matter's closed. Admonishment, oh so carefully delivered. Harmony has shown us the way. We're here to fight another day's by her will, more than any other's. So fight we shall, when and how the commander and his stepsons say. We've settled this, let it rest. Aegis and Archias, too quiet at their backs, are hanging on every word. Yes, Charon, Gorgias sighs, we've settled this. We've agreed. And Gorgias does at last let the matter drop as he and Charon circulate among the party-goers, Archias and Aegis yet following along behind. The four Thebans eat, they drink, they listen to the talk of storm gods and floodplains, of ruined crops and trade missions, of oligarchic decrees and weather to come. Above their heads the full moon rises among silvered clouds. The palace priest, Torchholder, seeks him out. Charon knows he should be flattered. He tries to explain to Torchholder that he is not ordained, not a real priest. When the Thebans came here, he was proclaimed leader by vote and priest by default. Somebody had to fill the clerical role.
"Let's not be coy, Charon," says Torchholder. "As one warrior priest to another, let's admit we both know what's happening here tonight."
The sanctuarite's priest's mouth twists irreverently. Charon puts on his wisest face, but doesn't understand. He must tread carefully among these heathens. Up came a slight balding man, and Torchholder introduced them.
"Retan, second oligarch of Sanctuary. This is Charon, of the Sacred Band of Thebes. I'll let Charon further introduce himself and his fellows." "Oh, more Timocrats! Glorious! I'd love to discuss with all of you what you recommend when honor cannot be the sole criterion for governance and still benefit the populace as well as its rulers and its military. And who are your colleagues?"
Charon introduced Archias and Aegis and brown-skinned Gorgias, thinking that the best pair to match wits with this oligarch would be Simmias and Perses, not Archias and Aegis, nor Gorgias and himself. "Gorgias, let's take Oligarch Retan to meet Simmias. He's our intellectual. He's kept company with some of the best minds in Thebes and even Athens. Gorgias knew what Charon wanted. Rescue. Obligingly, as if making amends for his earlier antagonism, Gorgias led the little man away, with Archias and Aegis in tow. But Torchelder was still standing there. "Don't you want to meet Simmias, Eminence? He's very intelligent."
"I want to talk to you alone," said Vashanka's priest. "Alone in crowds is always best."
And he started to walk, forcing Charon to keep up, headed toward the feast board with the lamb and carrots and rice where most Thebans were congregating.
"I've heard your son is paired with our homegrown seer, Artan. We're very pleased for them both."
The music faded. Charon stopped in his tracks. So much had happened. This priest was treacherous, he knew. And Molin knew too much about sacred band business. Charon was still adjusting to the news of his son's pairing. He should have been consulted, but he hadn't been. Different land, different customs. So Charon said, "It was a field promotion. By the commander himself, I didn't know until it was over. And yes, we're pleased. Our goddess is very proud of Lysis. As am I." What does he want, this lizard-eyed man, with his darting tongue and his devious heart? He gave Torchelder his most pious smile and waited for the man to speak. Several guests approached, but went away when they weren't acknowledged.
"I'd like your assistance," Torchelder said carefully, "in making sure that the introduction of your worshippers to our culture goes smoothly."
The moist wind picked up, tugging on the priest's velvet vestments. Then Charon thought he understood what Torchholder wanted. "Our goddess makes her own way. We can ask, but we follow. We do as she commands."
"We'd be very grateful if she'd command you and yours to stay within the laws of sanctuary. Not go around attacking private property that's empty, ransacking expensive estates and generally running amok."
The Mage Guild. Not until then had Charon realized that Torchholder might not believe in the god he served, or, believing, might think that he alone could interpret the will of the god. In Thebes this had been a very perilous circumstance whenever it arose.
"We go where the commander orders us. We fight where we're bid. We attack the targets we're given." "Yes, but I'm paying your salaries, and I don't like having to apologize to Rethan for breaking out every window in a property under his stewardship. Someone has to pay for all that damage, you know. And I want to take you over to Rethan once more and have you tell him that you and yours are sorry, and it won't happen again without prior consent from us."
"Us? The Riddler pays us, Thebans. We are the sacred band, loyal to our brothers and our commander."
"Yes, well, loyalties to your band are fine so far as they go. But you need to remember your first loyalty must be to the palace, me, the oligarchic council,
or the council's representative, me. Karen said very carefully, I think we should go find your oligarch, Retton. I'll apologize for shooting out the windows. And the rest? The rest you should take up with our commander. How is Corus doing? Karen didn't really care how Corus was doing. This priest was insidious. As they moved among the celebrants toward the festival lambs turning slowly on their spits above the fire pits, he thanked the goddess one more time for bringing him and his to this place where Lysis could live to become a man, not die surrounded by Spartans or Macedonians and doomed one way or the other, but in a land with neither. Here, where their goddess had come and blessed them all. The worst thing about this torch-holder was that he had chattered at Karen throughout their whole glorious twilight stroll. The priest was still nattering when they found Perseus regaling the oligarch with poetry, while gray-haired Simmias looked on fondly, and Aegis and Archias heaped wooden plates high with lamb, rice, and carrots. Torchholder was immediately drawn by Simmias into the crowd gathering around the poet. Gorgias, grinning, slipped away and met Karen over the wine service. Thus Karen didn't have to apologize to the oligarch about the damage to the Mage Guild.
Just think, Karen, we could be dead instead of eating all this delicious bounty in the moonlight on such a night as this, said Gorgias, sipping his wine.
Thank the goddess, Karen advised sternly, and they did. Finding the lamb's two eyes, a bit of oil and some fresh bread, and making an offering to Harmony over the fire pit before they themselves ate a bite. Karen looked up at the moon. Some night bird flew across it. The moon was full, and clouds were building. So he said, Storm's coming. And Gorgias agreed.
Ishard found Randall before Randall found the Riddler or Stealth. The necromant was slipping along the wall out of the torchlight wrapped in the velvet cloak of midnight blue.
Randall was shocked to see her, but, of course, she'd be here. Stratton was here, somewhere.
Randall had thought he'd need a horse for this. So he'd conjured a rather nice one, if smelling a bit loamy, from the lawn, and then realized that no one else had a horse inside the palace walls tonight. So he'd had to dispatch it. He'd chosen his customary hillman's trousers, the mottled tunic of Free Nisibis, and ankle-high boots. Thus he was decent, and if he wasn't dressed like a stepson tonight, he was dressed well enough.
Ishard, he called softly.
She shrank back in the bushes and then realized who he was. She was so beautiful. He was sad for her, that she felt the need to hide. Out from shadow she came, nearly creeping, looking around cautiously with her luminescent eyes. Randall offered her his arm.
Shall we? The food will be good if you're hungry.
Wrong thing to say, but the necromant took his arm and let her hood fall back, a sure sign she wasn't hunting for her dinner.
I've already eaten, she confirmed. But we must find the Riddler. Shamshi is here. I can smell him.
Those delicate nostrils quivered. That whitest skin, nearly incandescent, seemed to pale even more.
I'll help you find Tempus. Randall patted her arm,
He was grateful for her company. The palace lawn was huge, surrounded by high walls, crowded with celebrants. One hates to walk through a throng of revelers alone, unaccompanied, when everyone else has friends and lovers by their sides.
Now, where would the commander be?
Abruptly, Ashard stopped quite still. So Randall did. The necromant pulled on his arm.
Back up. Retreat.
Ashard was afraid of nothing in all creation as far as Randall knew. So when she asked it, Randall retreated with her. She pulled him by his sleeve over to a feast board with a haunch of bloody meat on it. At Ashard's urging, they each took plates, while Randall stood between Ashard and whatever frightened her.
"You can't be seen through me."
Randall stood up tall. He was a warrior mage. He could protect her if she needed protection from discovery, but beyond that, only up to a point.
"What was it? What is it?"
he whispered. Leaning so close to her, he could see the blood throb in a vein at her right temple.
"Them,"
she hissed.
"Them? Which them do you mean?" he whispered back.
"Shamshi and Ascalon. And if I'm not mistaken, Shamshi wears Nico's panoply."
"Oh, furies! Oh, by the writ and my soul's worth! Oh, no!"
Randall groaned. The Riddler not anywhere in evidence, Nico nowhere to be seen, and here on the lawn come the regent of the Seventh Sphere, the nearly omnipotent Dream Lord, and Shamshi, manifesting in Ashard's path. He sneaks a look, dares a glimpse. A tall, graying man and an indolently beautiful blonde youth are standing in full view, looking away into the crowd. The man had the height, the dignity, the regal bearing appropriate to the regent of the Seventh Sphere. The youth was not completely present, not wholly what a youth should be. More and less, and not at all what Randall expected of a Bandaran initiate who'd trained as a stepson. The bone and muscle were wrong somehow. Preternatural. Ethereal. But the youth wore a panoply the like of which only Nicodemus, and Randall, due to Nico's generosity, had ever worn. Was this the same panoply? Made by more than mortal hands? Moonlight was cuddling up to it, caressing it. Demons and gods at play were chasing across it, cavorting on it as if alive. Lightning bolts and the bulls and lions of the storm gods were emblazoned there. That panoply had saved Randall's life when he'd worn it. How could there be another like it? Was it the same Ascalon, standing before him, shoulders broad enough to heft a world, strength of deepest dream, darkest nightmare, animating flesh once belonging to an archmage, now demiurgic? And that flesh with its own unearthly glow, its strength beyond transience, how could it belong to anyone else? Firelight haloed the two of them, as if flame were tame, as if they were not mere flesh and blood, but reflections of some higher octave of being, some resonance of desire animated and strife harnessed, as if their forms were crafted, like Nico's panoply, from bloodshed, and inferno not entirely of this place or plane. Randall fought panic so deep it froze him mindless. Then he gathered his courage, lying all about in pieces. He stared over his shoulder, trying to get his bearings. He breathed deeply as Nico had taught him, seeking composure. He yelled with his inner voice to his 12th plane guide for help. Then, despite his pounding heart, he said,
"Sean, perhaps it's not really them. Perhaps that's not Nico's panoply. Ascalon made Nico's. Perhaps he has made another. And are you sure that Shamshi? It didn't look like him."
"I'm sure. I said I can smell him. I need to find Stratton."
Beyond Ashad, as if a world away, men in robes and armor were drinking and laughing. Women were parading in their finery, eating and teasing men to come and dance with them.
"Come with me first," Randall asked, trying not to plead.
Her sorcery was stronger than his. He was a mere thaumaturge.
"Come on, Ashad."
But she wouldn't. She stepped back and popped away in a rustle of wings. Now he was utterly alone. Alone among a host of celebrants, witnesses by the score if any mischief is afoot. Alone in the crowd so close to the Dream Lord and the fearsome wizard boy on the palace lawn. He longs to flee, the way Ashad has fled. But Randall is a stepson. He is the Riddler's warrior mage. He mustn't be afraid. If Shamshi has Nico's panoply, what could it mean? And why would Ascalon attack Randall in front of all of these? Randall had flown into the Mage Guild and out again with the keys. If Ascalon were after Randall, he could have struck him down there and then. No place or plane was safe enough to hide Randall from the Dream Lord. Randall was a mage, vulnerable to all the sortilege that had raised Ascalon up so high. Ascalon could have him any time, so what was he afraid of, here and now? Stepsons face their fears and their destinies straight on. So up he went to confront the Dream Lord. Oh, so politely, to see if Ashad was correct, to see if it really was Shamshi wearing Nico's panoply, as Nico would have done. He would stand eye to eye with Ascalon of Meridian and face up to this power who had chased Ashad away. And if Shamshi was beside the Dream Lord, then Randall would brave even that danger. By himself, since Ashad had deserted him. Without running for help, without quailing, as a stepson must do. And if evil came of it, then his commander and his partner and his brothers would have fair warning. Randall knew it was the right thing to do. The man upon whose shoulder he tapped was tall and gray-haired and wore a luxurious mantle. But when he turned around, the man didn't look like Ascalon. And the youth with him looked not at all like Shamshi, and wore no panoply whatsoever, just velvet and silk. Randall apologized and stumbled away through dancing happy people on the palace lawn until he found one stepson, who sent him to another, and another and another. When he was almost losing heart, he saw Stratton with his shard in a shadowed corner near the palace cisterns. He strode right up to them. His shard stepped back. Stratton looked around and said,
"Randall, your timing is getting worse every day. What is it?"
"It's what it wasn't. It wasn't Ascalon. It wasn't Shamshi. The younger man wore no panoply. It wasn't them."
"Fine, Randall," said Stratton. "Go away. Go find Crit. I want a moment with Ashad, alone."
Muted pipes played soft and low, lutes joined in, strings plucked and strummed. Ashad murmured to Stratton, touching his brow. Stratton blinked, shook his head, and took a step toward Randall. Just then Ashad spun away in a flap of wings. Stratton growled,
"Now look what you did, witchy ears. She's gone."
"I'm sorry,"
Randall replied, and he was. These two were as doomed as lovers can be.
If you're sorry, go tell Crit what Ishard told you, and that you think she's wrong if you must.
But Stratton wasn't angry, he was bemused. Stratton was always bemused after Ishard had had her hands on him. Randall hoped, tonight, that Ishard's effect on Stratton wouldn't be a problem. He told himself that Ishard wouldn't let her personal feelings or Strat's interfere with the hunt. By the time he found Jihan and Critias, such worries no longer seemed to matter. Randall hadn't remembered how forceful Jihan could be. She had Critias by the arm and was pulling on him. Her fingers were digging deep into his biceps.
"Critias, please come with me," Jihan said. "Let's go get something to eat." "Oh, Randall, Critias, tell Randall what you told me."
"If you let go of my arm, Jihan," she did.
Crit rubbed the finger marks there.
"Randall, we're on alert, watching out for the Dreamlord and Shamshi."
"Ishard was here, Critias. She smelled Shamshi here. Now she's left."
"Ishard was here and left? Why?"
Crit ran a spread hand through his short, feathery hair, a habitual gesture of frustration.
"I'm not sure. She thought she found Shamshi in Ascalon. First I thought she did. Then I thought she didn't. At least the two I saw didn't look like them."
"I'm sure," said a voice from behind him as Stratton came up and towered over him.
"She said Sham's here. She said they're both here. And I believe her."
"They are here," Randall nearly shouted, realizing finally that Ascalon had tricked him.
Corus is still chary of the right to come, so the sacred band must see to one of its own. Tempest waits for Corus, Nico, Artan, and Lysis to arrive, thinking that the god should prepare his own avatar. But the god won't, so Tempest must. Sometimes a man does what he'd most like to avoid. Vashanka's private chapel enfolds him. The chapel is dim, full of the god. So many of Tempest's own ghosts are here. He bows his head and greets them one by one. Shades and revenants from years gone by crowd in, murmuring like the dead he carries in his heart. A gilded chariot gleams in the chapel's soft light, a prop for a show he disdains, in these days when it is so hard for him to keep man and god separate, distinct from one another. When so many, many wraiths come with him, walk with him, ride with him from battlefield to battlefield, war to war, he hates waiting. But the stepsons are late, and he must tarry. As he waits, memories engulf him, collected over centuries, tokens from fated souls who died for reasons long forgot. Reasons never matter, once death comes cold and bold and takes the living by the hand. You count up your dead, everyone, always. He recalls them. Each and all, every face, every heart. Ritual rapes and slaughters and sacrifices. So many rites performed in this chapel to sate the hungry god. From former times till now, most far crueler than what the sanctuary audience will see tonight. In the glory days of Vashanka's armies, a girl was raped in a chariot on the run, buttocks up, bent over the front of the car on her stomach by two men and thrown out the back or off the side, when the deed was done. As a marriage bed, the stationary chariot with no horses came much later, along with the girl's backside dangling above the center pole, her knees hooked over the car's rim. In these gentler times, on this climb up from slime. Now even that is too real for these genteel folk, voyeurs of celestial passion, hoping for a brush with Godhead. Tonight there will be golden chains, velvet ropes, a willing wench, privileged to be ceremonially ravished by a youth who may, or may not, truly hold the god. They'll crown an avatar this evening, warp a boy's future, and think they've brought a god to life. Those who are praised to the heavens live a life of fantasy. Yet here was Tempest once again, laboring in Vashenka's chapel for this god whom he'd deserted for another. Or who had deserted him. He hoped that Kouris would have better luck than he'd had with Vashenka, lord of sack and pillage. When Kouris had been a babe, Vashenka had disdained him, fled, went missing, was cast down, or died, only to be reborn. To gods all things are good and just. There is never only one truth, if there is ever any truth in terms mortal men can grasp. Kouris came in alone, still in duty gear, shoulders hunched, head down, shuffling his feet. "Commander, thank you for being here." "Kouris," said the Riddler, "you'll be fine." Kouris was here to chase his jitters and inspect the preparations for the ritual. Tempest was here to inspect Kouris. As promised, the gilded chariot awaited, this son of the storm god, its center pole fastened to the stone floor by an iron ring. Tempest said, "Accompany me, Kouris." And they made their circuit, examining the chariot with its golden chains strung through rings in the car's floor. Chairs arranged in a circle around the chariot, the great statue of Vashenka frowning down. Nico comes in and goes straight to the chariot without a word, kicking at the wheel chocks, straddling the center pole, leaning first against the rise of the chariot's rim, and then pulling back, testing the chains, the steadiness of the wheels, the car. Finished, he turns and looks at Tempest's arms crossed. Lysis and Artan hurry in and flock to Nico. Struggling to keep their composure, as Stealth says, "The chains are strong. The brake is set. The center pole won't budge. The chocks on the wheels will hold the chariot still. It won't roll left to right. Unless you want to shim the undercarriage, it's done. Safe as can be." Although Nico stated his verdict emotionlessly, it is clear to Tempest that his right man disapproves. It's in his every move and in his eyes. "Kouris, you heard Nico. If you want to straddle the center pole, it won't roll away from you. If I were doing this, I'd step into the car rather than enact the rite from outside." "The choice is yours," Tempest said.
"If you say so, Commander," said Kouris doubtfully. Lysis put his fist to his lips, but snorted a gust of laughter. Artan punched him, and Lysis hit him back. Nico silenced them with a sharp hand sign. Both boys sobered. Tempest said, "Artan and Lysis, you stepson, stay with Kouris until Torchholder comes to get him. Artan, we hear your gift of prophecy is real. Is there anything you see that Nico and I should know tonight? Or that Kouris needs to know?"
"No, Commander."
Artan had been staring first up at the statue of Vashenka and then at Tempest. Some resemblance remained between the man and the statue of his former god. Artan gulped and reddened.
"I mean, I keep seeing Chironea. But everybody does who fought there."
Standing tall, Artan shifted his weight from foot to foot. No levity now, no giggles, no dancing eyes.
"I can't foretell on command. It
comes or it doesn't. Barton spread his hands, palms up. I hope you're not disappointed.
Nico stepped over the center pole. He came to Tempest's side, shaking his head almost imperceptibly. Let it be.
Thank you, Arden. Come to me any time.
And they left the boys there, exiting through the shelf wall passage. Tempest and Nico both knew this palace too well. Tempest had climbed up and down these marble stairs many times when Nico was sequestered here during the fight for Janny's soul. And after.
We all see Kyrenia, Nico remarked when they descended to the foyer with its floor of black and white marble squares.
And those words called it to Tempest's mind.
Long spears thunking into flesh, man staggering backward impaled.
Sometimes his heart still hurt. A beat would skip, a muscle would cramp somewhere. At Enlil's pleasure.
What do you think of Arden, Riddler?
Nico asked when Tempest didn't speak as they headed for the double doors leading out to the festivities on the lawn.
It's understandable that Arden sees Kyrenia, Tempest said. It was his first battle. That so many see it? Perhaps it's Shamshi, reaching out to touch their minds, as Jihan and Randall and Ashad think. This seer is young and untested. We'll learn what he is in time.
There were no sentries waiting. Tempest thought it strange, with so many guests outside. But when they pushed open the double doors, he saw the sentries on the outer stair talking with each other, eating from wooden plates. Beyond was merriment in the night. He counted his stepsons moving through the crowd, professional and polite. Torches flared. Music wafted. He saw Jihan and Critias with Stratton at a feast table talking to some Theban stepsons. Nico was walking toward them when the music stopped. Everyone on the vast lawn was stock still. Frozen in word or deed, asleep between blinks.
Tempest has seen this happen once before.
So, when Ascalon came wending his way through a crowd of stationary, unknowing revelers, he wasn't surprised. The last time this occurred, Nico had been new to Tempest's service and was saved from the Dream Lord's temporal suspension, because the young stepson had been meditating. Jihan was frozen in place, unmoving, with a bite of food on her dagger, halfway to her lips. Randall, beside her, had his mouth open, and the rest of the sacred band, Critias, Stratton, and the other stepsons, were ensnared by Ascalon's spell, as if time itself had stopped. The Dream Lord could twist time, hold it in abeyance, selectively. And at night, the Lord of Dream and Shadow was strongest. But Jihan was Stormbringer's daughter, a power in her own right. Despite himself, Tempest was impressed that Ascalon could reach Jihan and stop her in her tracks. The first time he'd ever seen Jihan, she had been on Ascalon's arm, swaggering across the training field at the barracks past all his unknowing stepsons, halted between breaths, not realizing that they couldn't move, or see, or feel. Yet Nico was wide awake, beside him, not frozen like the rest, not unknowing, not caught in stasis between heartbeats. Stealth said, "Commander, what do you want me to do?" Under his breath, Tempest touched the dart tube in his belt pouch. Nico's fingers tightened and relaxed on his new short sword, lifting it slightly and sliding it back into its scabbard. "Don't draw that sword. No fighting unless they start it." They.
Ascalon had someone with him tonight, as he had had that day, long ago. Only this time it wasn't Jihan, it was a young man, or something young and like a man. Up came the Dream Lord, with his friend matching him stride for stride. This younger man was grey of eye and dark of mien. Tempest wasn't sure it was Shamshi, or even human from the way its substance flickered, until the two were right in front of them and he saw Nika's panoply on the younger man. Nika took a sideward step toward Tempest. Both of them had left their shields inside the chapel, but this was not a battle that their stepson arms or armor would win.
Ascalon, Tempest said. I trust you are well. Introduce your friend.
Both wore dark raiment. Both were tall. A breeze blew softly in the Dream Lord's gray-starred hair. He was really here, not an illusion.
Shamshi, this is Tempest and his right man, Nicodemus. I think you've met before.
Ash's haughty sneer was under wraps. He too spoke carefully. He had a hand on Shamshi's arm. The youth glared at Tempest with pure hatred in his eyes, ignoring Nico as if he couldn't see him. Now Tempest couldn't quite take Shamshi's measure. The youth and the dream-forged panoply he wore seemed only partly visible, as if Shamshi were behind a waterfall or in a heavy rain, or only partially present. Then Shamshi took on more substance.
Riddler, I will destroy you yet, you and your favorite. For what you did to me, I will.
Ascalon raised his hand from Shamshi's arm and the young man was gone. Not frozen, not held in abeyance, not invisible, expelled. Tempest could feel the absence of the youth's hatred as if a wolf had slunk away into a pitch-dark night when lightning struck. Pop! Whoosh! Air clapped transiently, where nothing now was but something man-sized just had been. Tempest's ears felt as if they had been boxed.
"You must excuse Shamshi," Ascalon began. "He's young and full of vengeance."
While Ascalon spoke, Nico drew his sword reflexively, a reaction to the youth's disappearance and the booming, disturbed air rushing in to fill the void.
"No,"
Tempest warned, but Ascalon was quicker. Nico's short sword clattered to the ground, obedient to a wave of the Dream Lord's hand. Ascalon raised an eyebrow.
"Nicodemus, after all I've done for you, you lift a blade to me?"
"Ash, don't do this," Tempest says, as close to pleading with an adversary as he can remember. "Don't start this between you and me." With the fingers of his right hand, he delves into his belt pouch where a weapon lies that might skew all plans or might win the day. He doesn't know for certain. He doesn't really care. He has a courtyard full of unseeing stepsons, an entire sacred band of reasons not to let this malicious demiurge do more harm. But Ascalon ignores Tempest.
"Nicodemus, do you really think to threaten me?" asks the Dream Lord sardonically. "I make you a panoply worthy of a god, and you sell it? I offer you the secrets of the universe?"
Ash is pointing his finger at Nico, and Nico is stock still, short sword at his feet.
And you reject me time after time?
Nico's eyes are moving now, and his left hand is inching toward his belt where his throwing stars nestle. Then Ascalon brings his fingers slowly down, and Nico down, onto bended knee. The entelechy of dream takes another step toward Nicodemus, and Ash says,
I promised Sham I wouldn't kill you again. He wants that pleasure for himself. And I had thought that your mentor here cared more about you than to let you suffer the way you will from now on.
At that, Tempest pulls out the loaded dart tube. He puts it to his lips. He blows. The dart flies straight and true into the Dream Lord's neck, above the dark cloak where the pale skin is thin. Ascalon slaps at his neck, but does not stagger, doesn't fall down dead. Instead, the Dream Lord howls, a sound that pounds eardrums across the lawn.
Tempers, it is between us now, eternally!
Ascalon snarls as he melts away, as fast as he had banished Shamshi to some other place. In the Dream Lord's wake, people stir, clap their hands to their ears, and with shocked expressions wipe their bleeding noses and one another's. And stagger once or twice. Nico, still on one knee, picked up his sword. Tempest put out a hand to help him, but was rebuffed by an open palm. I can do it, I'm fine. Stealth scrambled to his feet, shaking his head to clear it as Molin came running up to them.
What was that? Such a thunderclap! Everyone has nosebleeds. We wanted the Storm God, but perhaps not quite so much of him.
The priest rubbed his nose and smeared dripping blood around his upper lip. Nicodemus swiped the back of his hand under his own nose and inspected the hand that came away, unbloodied. He sheathed his sword, his eyes downcast. Tempest had to answer the priest. You asked for thunder. We'll see if Chorus can moderate himself. He's only a boy, after all. Go hand out cloths and water to your guests and tell them how fortunate they are that blood, shed from the nose on the occasion of this ritual, ensures good fortune for the enterprise. And those who give this blood sacrifice to the god Vashanka are doubly blessed.
Of course, I knew that,
huffed the priest, wheeling on his heel in a flurry of claret velvet, and hurried off to instruct his staff, leaving Tempest and Nico eye to eye. So? He asked his partner.
I'm so sorry, Nico said. I should have waited. But all I could think was that Sham was attacking. When he disappeared like that, that he'd reappear right in front of me, or behind me, and I needed to be ready to engage him.
Think nothing of it. They came here to make us angry, goad us. We must pick our battles as we always have. With care, whenever possible. Not fight on someone else's terms, not haphazardly. Are you hurt?
Nico flexed his sword hand.
No, I'm fine. The Dream Lord just pushed me down with his little finger. I didn't think he would.
Then he turned to Tempest.
And Shamshi, wearing my old panoply,
coming and going and glaring and flickering. Was he here or not? Would it have mattered if I put my sword into him?
Good, Nico, you're learning. What was here was something under wraps, held very tight, much different from the sham we knew. Ash didn't dare let Shamshi manifest completely. That boy is out of control. Good for us, bad for them. Control may make all the difference on the day. But make no mistake, the battle is joined. With the Dream Lord, not just the Wizard Boy. Till the end, of them or us. I've avoided this conflict for more years than you've been alive. And now it's here.
I brought this on us. Nico ducked his head. But the poison dart will kill him, won't it? He asked hopefully.
It didn't drop him on the spot. Remember, time is his ally, not ours. Poison works in time. It will have an effect, make him angrier, for certain.
Shamshi and Ash weren't his most pressing concerns right now. We need to see if all of ours are well, Tempest said. But it was Nico he needed to judge. Too much was happening, too fast, to Nicodemus. Stealth wasn't sure what to expect of himself or anybody else. They went among the revelers, all talking about the mighty thunderclap that made so many noses bleed and so many ears ring. Nico was steady on his right, ready to strike at anything that moved, hand always on his sword hilt as if he could still seek out and destroy this foe who'd come, threatened him, dropped him to bended knee in front of Tempest, and then gone. Instead of an enemy, they found Jihan, the only one who had an inkling of what had really happened. She soothed.
Stealth, don't take it badly. Or not worse than I. I am a froth daughter, strong as the tides. And he froze me. Ash does not fight fairly. He dared to lift a hand in anger against Stormbringer's own begotten daughter. When I almost wed him once.
We will have our revenge, Nico, I promise. We may already have had it, Nico said in a low voice as Randall came toward them across the lawn with Critias and Stratton not far behind, walking backward, scanning the crowd.
What do you mean? Jihan whispered.
The poison dart. Nico said, quietly. The tube.
Riddler? You didn't. Did you?
Jihan demanded, aghast. Tempest shook his head. Not now. Not with Critias approaching and Stratton and Randall close by. Jihan! Nico means that with you so affronted, the problem's surely solved. Ash has offended a froth daughter. Certainly his days are numbered. The froth daughter huffed a bit, but when Randall arrived, greeting her with a hug, Jihan beamed like sunrise and began tending to the mage, whose nose was still bleeding. Randall said, sniffling with his face toward heaven and Jihan peering up his nose,
Riddler, I saw Ascalon and Shamshi. Ishard did. I warned Stratton and Critias, but when we looked again, we couldn't find them. We all tried and tried. Shamshi has Nico's panoply.
It's not the weapon or the armor that makes the man, Randall, Tempest told him. Then Nico shifted on his right, reaching around Jihan to touch Randall's arm in greeting. Encouragement given by the tall fighter and received by the slight big-eared mage without a word. Crit and Strat bore down on them, a phalanx of two, bodies angled left and right, peering at every shadow, every stranger.
Life to you, Riddler, Crit said wryly. An everlasting glory.
Strat's sour face said he doubted much glory could be found here tonight among the throng of fat men and powdered ladies on the palace grass.
And to you both, and to you all, Tempest said. Critias, Stratton, the Dreamlord and the wizard boy have come and gone, with no one the wiser. The battle is joined. Redouble your precautions.
And Tempest thought in that moment that these five were the best he'd ever had. Only the gods knew how many more nights like this they might have, how many more times they'd stand together like this and talk together like this. Crit said, very quietly, looking all around this public place for prying eyes or pricked ears,
I'll be damned and roasted.
Our fault, Commander. But all mine are trying their best. How are we going to stop Ascalon and Shamshi? United.
Strat grimaced.
We're not. This fight will be on their terms, not ours, he said fatalistically.
Crit couldn't let it go at that. He whistled a maneuver code. From all directions, stepsons gathered, crowding around Critias for new orders in the wake of the thunderclap. That was all anyone remembered. None of them had seen the Dreamlord or Shamshi, but they knew Crit, curt and cold, knew his face like they knew their own nightmares, knew his urgency for what it was. Crit ordered,
"Bring me a Dreamlord, bring me a wizard boy, now!"
Men moved off, hunting for shadows they couldn't find. Trying the impossible with all their might. From the corner of his eye, Tempest kept watch on stealth. His partner was obedient beside him. First, suspicious, then wary, then vigilant as his senses quested through the crowd. Was Nico seeking Ascalon, Shamshi, or his goddess? Above their heads, real thunder rumbled as the lightning promised by boy and god began to flash. Guests headed for the shelter of the chapel or their homes. Tempest stayed by Nico, alert as his sacred band sorted out the crowd. Some to leave, some to stay and file indoors. If Ascalon or Shamshi or both were yet among the throng, this was when the danger for his stepsons would be the greatest. Scrutinizing everything, waiting for Critias and Stratton to signal them, Nico said to him, "Commander, let Ascalon take hold of me. Let him put me on my knees. You told me not to start anything." He shrugged.
"You didn't. They did. You did what I ordered you to do. There'll be chances enough to be a hero in the days to come. You're not a berserker. Unthinking rage is not a strength. It's a disability. You'll have your opportunity to face Shamshi when his protector turns him loose or when Ash is dead. Ash held on to Sham. I held on to you. There's a balance in that, some degree of mot."
Nico's quick, canny grin came and went. So perhaps Tempest had not overstepped tonight, after all. He had never meant to challenge Ash directly. He'd avoided it so carefully these many years. The Lord of Dream and Shadow was not an opponent whom any man, immortalized or not, would choose. But it was time to make a stand for the sake of Nico's soul and his own and everybody else's. He hoped Jihan was right about the ancient weapon having deadly results, even on gods and those who were beyond the laws that gods and men obey. Because Ascalon was one of those. As long as Ash had coveted Nico, there had been rancor between Tempest and the Dreamlord. But now, enmity had changed into something far worse. If Ascalon had angered destiny and Shamshi was just an instrument, then the fates might yet have their day.
Greater dooms bring greater destinies. He couldn't have been more grateful to Nico's goddess. At this moment, when the risk surpassed any he'd known before, his right-side partner could hold his own.